Welcome into another edition of the Dane and Victory podcast, only on musketeerreport.com. I am Rick. He is Dan. And Dan, this is the 44th edition of the podcast.
Rick, one of my favorite sports memories was in 2010. If you remember when the Reds clinched the division on the Jay Bruce walk-off for the getting to the playoffs for the first time in however long it had been. And I was downtown, all my friends were, you know, drinking and carrying on late into the night. And at some point during the night, and there's a photograph of this, I executed a bro hug with Eric Davis on Fountain Square, who was one of my sporting idols as a kid. So I think 44, it's got to be the Eric Davis edition.
Did you see the? Did you say there was a picture of this? Like, there's picture evidence of the bro hug? Because I'm envisioning this being rather awkward, like an awkward situation. Was this in a bar? Where was this at?
No, it was just down in Fountain Square. He was doing he was doing a lot of bro hugs.
Gotcha.
It was a very touchy feeling.
You were just a number. You were just a number to him. Then it wasn't that personal.
Look, you know. All right. Well, we come to this podcast under much better circumstances than the last one, Rick. Since last we spoke, the Musketeers defeated Providence at Cintas Center on Saturday, the 8th of February, snapping a three-game losing streak in Big East play, 59-53. On Tuesday, last night, actually, we're recording this Wednesday night, February the 11th, the Musketeers went to Staples Fieldhouse and pounded the Butler Bulldogs. Final score was 64-50, but as we'll talk about a little bit later, it was much more lopsided than the final score indicates. Taking stock of the Musketeers at the moment, they're 17-7 on the season, 7-4 in Big East play. That's third place by themselves. And in the upcoming week, we'll talk about a little bit later, the Muskies will travel to Milwaukee to take on the Marquette Golden Eagles on Saturday afternoon, new start time, 4 p.m. And then on Wednesday back at home against cellar-dwelling DePaul. Rick, this was a week where Xavier rediscovered their identity, I feel like, on the defensive end.
Yeah, I mean, that's obviously the huge takeaway from these last two games is that they've returned to that type of team that can get stops and make it tough for the other team to score. And the Providence game was really impressive, what they did defensively in the second half of that one against Bryce Cotton. And obviously the huge matchup in this game when you're talking about the Providence matchup was Samaje on Cotton. Last time, Mac had D. Davis on him. This time, he decided to go with Samaje because of the athleticism, and I thought that was the biggest difference in the game. We Samaje talked about guarding Cotton after the game, and like he said, it was more than just him.
Samaje, you kind of had the lion's share of defending Cotton, especially at the end of the
game.
That's
Doc, by the way.
Discuss what it's like chasing him around the court, and also the steal that was probably the pivotal play of the game.
It's tough chasing him around, but if you locked in, you should be all right. And my teammates helped me a lot when he was coming off screens. They was right there, so he wouldn't shoot it or put it on the ground. And the steal, I just kind of read it because he kept going to the move every time he came off the screen. So it was just like I just set down on the crossover.
And Dan, that steal at the end of the game was, I think, kind of symbolic almost of the game. I mean, it was kind of summing up the game all in one play of Samaje kind of put the nail in the coffin with that great individual defensive effort. And that was kind of the story of this game, was his individual effort on Cotton with the help of his teammates, like you mentioned, was really just the difference from the first time they played him.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I thought there were a couple things about this game that showed that X had addressed some of the problems they had, particularly against Villanova and Seton Hall as well. They didn't get off to a terrible start. I mean, Providence did score on their first two possessions, but X was able to answer. The Musketeers are up 10-5, I think, at the second TV timeout. And although Providence led for much of the first half, they were never able to get a whole lot of separation. And when they did get a little bit of a lead, and it was mostly through, you talked about Bryce Cotton and the emphasis Xavier put on guarding him, but it seemed mostly to be Josh Fortune getting open for threes. X was really playing pretty well in the first half. They couldn't get into an offensive rhythm, but they were getting decent shots. They weren't throwing the ball around, and they were getting victimized by threes on the other end, which has been a problem all year long. But I thought for the most part their effort was pretty good in the first half. One thing I did notice, Rick, this was something that cropped up in the second half, is I thought this was a game where the officials really struggled to control the flow of the game. And in the second half, they struggled to make objective calls. But in the first half, the first possession of the game, this happened right in front of you, actually. Matt Stainbrook and Kadeem Batts were basically having a mid-80s WWF-style cage match in the key for that whole possession. And the refs were just watching it happen. And as that was happening, I was like, oh, boy, it is going to be an old school physical Big East game underneath. And I thought that particular matchup was critical in this game too, Stainbrook and Batts.
Yeah, I don't know if you saw, but I think D'Artagnan was actually trying to slide Stainbrook the steel chair there in that beginning of the game when they were wrestling. But you hit the nail on the head with the refs. It was a weird game from that perspective and the way they called it, without question. And then some of the turnover when they turned the call over on the out of bounds, where Providence had clearly just thrown the ball out of bounds and they said X had deflected it. And then I heard someone had said on the replay, it was like, you know, you could see at least 3 feet in between the closest X defender's hand and the ball. So,
yeah, I went, my parents were over at my house after the game. We all sat down. We actually watched some of the replay. And on that one, everybody was going completely nuts. But Rick, one thing when we talked about the beginning of this game, Coach Mack made an adjustment from the starting lineup. He inserted Eric Stenger at the four, jumped center, and then played up to the first TV timeout. I think he only had 5 minutes for the game. I think they were all in that first run. Then in the Butler game, did the same thing. Stenger started the game, played the first 4 minute war, as the Musketeer coaching staff calls it. What was your take on that adjustment? And do you think it seemed like it paid dividends, because Fillmore had a pretty good game both times, and X seemed to start better in both games? Why did Coach Mack choose to do that, do you think? And what effects did it have, if any?
Well, Max said, you know, Shannon asked him about it after the Providence game, and he said he was trying to send a message to Isaiah, but that the message was going to stay between them. And they had, you know, they had clearly communicated about it before the game. And then you saw, I guess, since it did seem to work in the Providence game, then they carried it over to the Butler game. I think this is a matter of trying to get Isaiah going, both with his attitude on and off the court, and having him be a positive influence on the team and be a positive leader. I think, you know, sometimes when he was struggling, he was wasn't bringing the energy that they needed on the defensive end, and they still trust him more than anyone else in the post right now when it comes to, or I shouldn't say that with Stainbrook, but when it comes to the other guys that play the four with Farr and Reynolds, he's still the most trusted by the coaching staff, and Stenger included in that as well. But he hasn't obviously had the type of year physically and defensively that they would like. So they're going to keep trying to get Reynolds more minutes, and we'll talk about more about him in a second, but Stenger is part of that as well. So I think kind of trying to motivate Fillmore by bringing him off the bench, and also maybe not letting him pick up that first foul within those first 4 minutes, like it seemed like he was rather prone to do. And so far it's worked. So I think they'll stick with it until it doesn't work anymore, or Stenger really starts hurting them playing in those first few minutes of the game.
Rick, with about, I'm going to say, I'm checking the, checking the play-by-play at the moment, but Providence had their biggest lead of the game with just over a minute left in the first half at 32-29. And then the Musketeers really, really ratcheted down, I thought, defensively. In the last minute of the first half, the Musketeers scored twice to trim the lead from 32 to 27 to 32-31.
Which was
then in
huge.
The second half. Yeah, and then in the second half, the Musketeers opened with a 9-2 run that got them to a lead of 40-34 with just about 17 minutes left. And that 6-point lead seemed to be sort of the stasis where the game sat for the next 10 minutes. When you look back at that particular passage of play, what was X doing that allowed them to hold the Friars down offensively and turn those defensive stops into baskets at the other end?
Well, Providence isn't a great shooting team. We talked about that the first time, but the lackadaisical defense by Xavier, and part of it, you always hear how important those first couple minutes to start the game and to start the second half are, and Xavier just wasn't coming out of the locker room for whatever reason with a lot of energy, both at the beginning of the games and after halftime. That hadn't been a good stretch for Xavier during that three-game losing streak, but they were much better in this Providence game, and it's just a matter of focus. You can't give up that easy shot as you're kind of they're dipping their toes in the water to start the game, to steal a phrase from Coach Mack, and instead of just jumping in and getting after it defensively, and then you give up a quick three or you give up a couple quick threes and a jump shot, and all of a sudden you're down by multiple possessions, and that hurts. Digging yourself a hole like that is tough to get out of. Instead, they trimmed that lead right before half. They came out on the run, took the game over, and never looked back. And you know, that was a big thing in the Butler game too. We mentioned that they've gotten off to better starts, but it's really been those key runs at the beginning of the second half, because they did the same thing in Butler where it was kind of still a close game right around halftime, and they made the run and just ended it.
Yeah, and if you look at if you compare the performance, the efficiency ratings and so forth from the first game between Xavier and Providence, it's a pretty stark contrast. I mean, Providence's offensive efficiency in the first Xavier game adjusted was 120.1, which is really, really good. In the second game, it was 90.3, which is roughly 0.9 points of possession, which is really, really bad. Similarly, you know, X didn't actually play much better offensively than they did in the first game. That was a relatively good offensive output for the Muskies. It's 72 points at Providence. But yeah, I think the story of this game was Xavier's defense. So that was the first run in this game. The second one was Providence went on a last year Xavier run toward the end of this game. The Musketeers had forced the lead. And first of all, this is one stat that I did observe during the game. I think I may have tweeted about it, but I went back through the play-by-play to verify it. Xavier had, I believe it was 7 possessions in this game where they had a 6-point lead and the ball, and they scored 0 points on those 7 possessions. And that kind of, I think, shows you that the Musketeers had opportunities in the second half of this game to put Providence away. They couldn't do it. And a lot of it was that I think D. Davis had a little bit of a rough go of it, especially in the second half. He had one passage where he just had 2 or 3 bad decisions in a row. I thought that another problem for X was that Providence was getting, you know, some friendly whistles. You mentioned the overturn of that ridiculous pass out of bounds, but then there was a held ball called on a blocked shot that Stainbrook had where the ball was never held. There were a couple questionable out of bounds and foul calls, and it seemed like every time it led directly to a Providence 3. So the Friars were hanging on, and then in the last 6 or so minutes of the game, with X holding a 6-point lead, as I said, the Muskies went on this extended drought for like 6 minutes. But during that time, critically, they held Providence only 5 points. So the Friars could only get the lead down to 1 point during that extended period of time. And then the Musketeers eventually, as we'll talk about in a second, were able to put it away in the last minute. So I thought that defensive stand, that defensive effort was obviously one of the changing points of that game.
Yeah, that game reminded you of Xavier last year when they were at their best. You know, they still couldn't make shots from the outside. D wasn't giving them a huge lift offensively, but they played just well enough on offense, and their defense was very good, and they were able to limit an elite guard like Bryce Cotton from scoring and still be able to come out with a win despite their offensive struggles and their limited offensive skill. But this was a game that was huge because it was for third place in the conference, but it was also kind of one of those turning point games. You lose that one, you go 4 in a row. At that point, you think your season in the Big East, it's going to be a huge uphill battle to do anything and have a chance of really setting yourself up for a tournament run. Now, with that win, it kind of gets the confidence back up. You turn around, you pick up the win on the road at Butler, and now you're right back in position. You're in third all to yourself. You got a game separation, and things are really looking up, and it all started with this Providence win that they had to come up with despite not shooting the ball all that well on the offensive end.
When the game got to winning time, as they call it, Samaje Christen was at his best. Can you walk us through the way he took this game by the scruff of the neck in that last, I don't know, minute and 5 seconds?
Well, I thought you heard it from him right there in that quote. The one thing I've really enjoyed about watching Samaje this year, especially after the games and the postgame press conferences, is how much he's matured and just being comfortable with talking to the press. He still doesn't like to say a whole lot. He's not a great speaker by any means, but he's to the point where he's comfortable enough to express himself and get his point across. And he's very simple. And he said it right there to you know, he had been reading Cotton the whole time, using that crossover move every time he went to reject a ball screen, and Samaje was waiting on it. It got inside a minute. I think there were like 40 seconds left there. It was a 2-point game, a chance to tie it up for Providence. He went to use that same crossover and reject the ball screen, and Samaje ripped it from him, and that was the game all in one play. But it wasn't just that. Samaje goes down the court on that he's got two guys ready to block his shot. He has eyes on the back of his head, dishes it off to Fillmore, who dunks it in. I know Kristen also had a finish in transition a little bit before that too to help put Xavier up. So
he got to the line, but yeah,
he
made an aggressive move, got to the line, hit one or two to put the lead back at two before the steal. Yeah, I thought that breakaway and the dish to Isaiah Fillmore for the dunk was an example of what an incredible athlete Samaje Kristen is, and how good his basketball sort of awareness is. We talked about it a lot last year on the show. Honestly, we talked about it a lot because we didn't have a whole lot else to talk about. But Samaje just has its sixth sense on the basketball court. It's one of those things that I'm pretty sure that you're born with. It's like in golf, how pretty much anybody can get to the point with enough practice that they can shoot 80, but getting to the point where you're a professional level golfer requires some God-given ability. I think Samaje just has that knack, and you saw it there because it was an awkward move to the basket for him. He was dribbling with his left hand, which is not his preferred hand. He had Cotton sort of in his body,
and coming up underneath of him. Yeah.
And then he had a shot blocker coming in from the weak side toward the left hand block. So he wasn't going to be able to get a layup up. And also he was sort of awkward. He was almost staggering toward the basket the last few steps. And yet he had the presence of mind to dip down, to get the shot blocker in the air, to dip down and to slide it back to Fillmore for the dunk. Also a lot of credit, you know, goes to Fillmore, and I think I want to say it was Justin Martin, but I could be wrong. There was another Xavier player that was filling that lane as well. So the Musketeers really reacted to that and were ready to tip in. If Samaje had gotten a shot up to the glass, it probably would have been tipped in by a Musketeer anyway. But that was such a critical finishing flourish for the Muskies. And I don't know that you can I don't know how big that game is, and we'll talk about this with the Butler game too. I don't know how big that game is when you look at Xavier's tournament resume. I mean, nobody's going to say, oh, they split with Providence. That's a mark in their favor. But halting that 3-game slide, getting yourself more solidly on the plus side, the plus 500 side in Big East play, and reasserting your defensive identity, I think – was huge. And so for me, that was the takeaway from this game, was that X's defense came back. They held Providence to, I believe it was just 23 points in the second half, including just 7 in the last 10 minutes of the game. So that to me was the takeaway from this game, was X's defense reasserting themselves.
Well, and one thing we do need to talk about, and this goes on into the Butler game, but this was obviously Jalen's first game back, and it was also the first game where this team sort of seemed to turn it around defensively, and he was a part of that. I mean, he played more minutes. I think he played 12 in this game, and it was, you could tell that they're a different team when he's on the court because of the athleticism that he brings. We've talked about
5 rebounds.
Right. I mean, and he only played what was it? 10 or 11 minutes?
11 minutes.
11 minutes. There you go. That's productivity on the glass. But defensively, too, we've talked about the struggles this team has had, and a lot of them have related to they're a little slow off the ball. They don't recover all that well with their bigs. You know, teams can get them in some problematic situations with ball screens because the bigs have to hedge and they're not quick enough to recover. Well, that isn't necessarily a problem when he's on the court. And we really started to see that in this Providence game, you know, with him, this being his first game back, obviously Chris Mack was asked about him, but so was Matt Stainbrook. And I thought it was kind of interesting the answer Matt Stainbrook gave, because he talked about the energy and how excited Jalen was to come back.
Matt, maybe the fact you guys got Jalen back, what's that mean for you? you know, he's been a huge energy boost, and you can tell even just from the minute he was able to practice with us again, and you know, leading up to this game, he's been a guy who's been really energetic, and I think it's, you know, it's sort of resonated for him of how important it is, you know, take care of your daily duties and you know, not going into things, but you know, he's a guy that I think's learned a lot, and he's grown up a ton even the past couple days, and he is really excited to be back, and you know, it's great to have him you know, definitely come in for stretches and help us defensively and offensively. He's a guy who's really lanky and, you know, makes it really hard for offenses to drive in the paint and have unobstructed shots.
And of course, Stainbrook uses words like unobstructed, which is probably one of one time you'll hear that from a college basketball player this year. But I mean, he's exactly right. I mean, that's perfect analysis of what Jalen can bring for this team. And I think this is going to be critical as we go down the stretch of the season. Jalen Reynolds is an athlete unlike any other athlete they have in the program right now. I mean, obviously Samaje's on that level at the guard position, but as far as big men, he is a game changer in the lane. And now that he's starting to show that confidence and maturity and understanding of what the coaches want out of him and where to be, you're starting to see him not have to think as much on the court, and he's just reacting and playing his game. And that's a huge boost for this team. And I think that he could be a big part of the solution to their defensive problems. And we've already seen that in back-to-back games. Maybe not against two teams that score the ball all that well, but when you look at it, there aren't a whole lot of teams in the Big East who really do score it that well. I mean, you've got Villanova and Creighton, and that's about it. Then, Dan, obviously Chris Mack had comments about Jalen being back as well.
Jalen's being a more responsible student, a more responsible you know, guy away from the basketball court, and that's all we ask out of our players is to be men off the floor. Learn from their mistakes, and I'm hopeful that Jalen has learned a lesson and doesn't cost our team in the future. He did a great job today.
You know, and I was kind of wrong. Last podcast we talked about this, and I said, you know, this doesn't hurt the team all that much, but it is going to set back Jalen and his development for this year, because you were hoping he could become a kind of a big part. Well, as quickly as he came back from that suspension, and he's picked up right where he left off and continued his progress already immediately, and he saw even more minutes, played 16 in the Butler game last night. I mean, he is, I think, going to be a big part of this team down the stretch run of the regular season and the rest of the Big East and then into postseason play.
Well, let's move on to the Butler game. And I want to start off by sort of setting the stage a little bit, because when X played Butler in that game in early January on a Saturday afternoon at Cintas, it was a extremely well-played college basketball game, and Butler and Xavier really went back and forth until you know, the last minute of the game before the Musketeers really were able to pull away, and they made some foul shots down the stretch and ended up winning by 11. But that was a one possession game for a lot of the second half. And then Butler fell off the face of the earth. This is a team that is now, what, 2-10 in Big East play. And they looked like a completely different team at Hinkle yesterday. I think I was able to process the idea that Butler had struggled in Big East play. And I guess I wanted to just say, well, they got into a bunch of overtime games. They don't have a dynamic point guard like some of the teams in this league do. So they've lost a lot of close games, but they're really not that bad. They looked terrible last night. And to a level that I did not expect this Butler team to play. To play that poorly. And I think you mentioned that it seemed like that you were up at Hinkle last night, and you said that, I think on Twitter, that the atmosphere was completely dead at the Fieldhouse. And it just seems like this has become a real slog of a season for the Butler faithful.
Well, two things there on how poor they looked. One, I think this isn't, you know, they obviously a few weeks ago they were playing a little bit better basketball, but I think a lot of that can be contributed to the fact that when you keep losing close games like they have throughout this Big East schedule, it wears on you as a team mentally, especially when you got some young guys leading the way, and it's becoming tough on Kellen Dunham, because he's the only guy who can score offensively. Defenses are game planning to stop him, so he's getting frustrated. It's getting tougher for him to make shots. So I think they're a lot quicker now to, if you play really well as the opponent and take it to them early, they're a lot quicker now to say, here we go again, and all of a sudden they let down a little bit.
Let me ask you something. This may be an interesting hypothetical, or it may be a stupid question. If Xavier had joined the Big East last year, is the season that Butler's having this year what maybe we would have seen X do had they been in Big East play last year?
Yes. Yeah, I think that's a really good way to compare it. You know, the one thing Xavier would have had the advantage of is they still would have had Samaje, who gives them right now. Butler's relying on a guy who's not an elite athlete, who's not great at creating his own shot. He relies on running off screens and having his teammates drive and kick to him and Kellen Dunham, because he's a shooter, but he can create his own shot, but he's not great at it. He's not an elite athlete, where Xavier would have had a little advantage in that sense. But yeah, I think that the season would have been very similar. They're very similar teams in the fact that they're just so limited offensively, even though they're disciplined defensively, and even though they run good stuff on the offensive end, they just don't make enough shots. And like I said, I think it wears on you. If you keep losing those close games, eventually you get to the point where it's here we go again when you get down. And that's what we saw yesterday. But I think you do have to give Xavier a lot of credit, because Butler came with a game plan that could have given them trouble. And heck, with the way Xavier's handled post traps in the past, when you think back to Kenny Freeze when teams did that to him, and even to an extent last year when teams were doing it to Travis Taylor at times and giving him trouble, Butler could have very well had a game plan that worked last night. Xavier could have turned the ball over and a lot and given them points at the other end, and it could have been a much closer game. But instead, Xavier was very patient on the offensive end. Their ball movement was crisp. The bigs, particularly Jalen and Isaiah Fillmore, did a great job of handling the post traps, and then D. Davis was able to knock down a couple shots, which we've talked about so many times this year. It makes a huge difference for this offense.
I think all offensive teams are reliant on confidence to a certain extent. Basketball, as my old roommate Brian used to say, every game is a game of runs. But this is a team that it almost seems to snowball even more because more guys get involved. I always think of that last run against Georgetown where we talked about how every single player in the rotation was contributing. Well, here's a game where D. Davis, who'd had four straight pretty bad games, comes in and is playing lockdown defense on Kellen Dunham from the first minute of the game instead of just in the second half, like in their first meeting, and also hits three rainbow threes in the first half, a couple of them at really crucial times for X when Butler had eaten into the lead a little bit. And then another huge factor, I thought, for Xavier was that Isaiah Fillmore came into this game at the first TV timeout, in relief of Stenger, and Butler, the players that Butler had guarding him were giving him no respect with his mid-range game. And he hit, I want to say, four 15-foot or so jump shots during that game, which, again, helped soften up that Butler defense. You talked about Butler's strategy, which was to immediately double the post. They also, they seem to be... That was basically what they were trying to do, but Xavier's ball movement and their passing was so crisp and so confident that a lot of times it just looked like a bunch of guys running in random directions for Butler. And when you see that, that's a really good thing for an offense. X had to weather foul trouble for Justin Martin in the first half. He looked like a guy who was really excited to play in front of the hometown fans, and as a result, got himself in immediate foul trouble. But you had Samaje playing very confidently and just really taking poor Alex Barlow to the woodshed in the first half. D. Davis hitting a few shots. Miles Davis had a nice had a couple nice shifts off the bench, which we haven't seen in a while. And Brandon Randolph really got into the swing of things in this game too. He had a nice runner in the first half off a sort of a secondary break, and then hit a three in the second half.
How about that?
It was nice to see him gaining a little bit of confidence. This was a good game for the bench, I thought. A lot of bench minutes for the Muskies. Fillmore, not really a bench player, but he got 23 minutes. Reynolds and Miles, 16 apiece. Brandon, 11. James, 7. And then Little Stainbrook with 2 during garbage time. So a lot of guys got some good floor time this late in the season, which you don't often see. And maybe that'll pay dividends for the Musketeers later. But this was definitely a game where they built their confidence, especially on the offensive end.
Yeah, well, and anytime you can win with Stainbrook only scoring 6 points, you're in a much better spot than the Muskies were a couple weeks ago. And that's great that some, it doesn't necessarily matter who it is. We talked about that earlier in the year. A lot of times it's been Justin Martin. Earlier in the year, it was maybe Miles Davis and James Farr on occasion. But last night it was Isaiah Fillmore, and that's fine too. If he can knock down a 15 footer and D Davis can knock down a couple threes, that's great. But the difference that happened is after they started making those shots, all of a sudden, those post traps, the guys who were going to make the post traps had to come about 3 steps farther to make them, because now when they were guarding their man, they were out on the perimeter instead of playing 3 steps off of them waiting for Samaje to penetrate or the ball to be thrown into the post. And when you keep stretching the defense out like that, they end up just chasing the ball when you're able to move it the way Xavier was last night. And Chris Mack talked about it a little bit with the post traps, and he gave Jalen Reynolds a lot of credit for the way he handled them.
Well, the adjustment the brothers made here is, as we've all transitioned to a team with deeper and more athletic and larger front courts, is they're post-trapping a lot. They're trying to get the ball out of the five and four's hands on the other team. So we knew the post-trap was coming. I thought Jalen did a great job. You know, he played hot potato with the basketball and got out right away. Matt tried to make the home run pass a few too many times rather than just make the simple play. But the times that we did get out safely, we swung it around and got wide open shots, and it was good. We needed to hit some shots. We hadn't really necessarily done that over the last few games. But, you know, if you post trap and you do a really good job of getting the ball out of the trap, somebody's going to be open, and you know, fortunately we were able to knock down some shots and sort of use that against them.
Well, there you go. Dan, this was one of the weirdest trips to Hinkle for me, because I guess I've been going the last three times that Xavier's played at Hinkle, I've been there. And all three of those were ruckus crowds. I mean, completely packed. There were, you know, a decent little contingency of Xavier fans each time up in the corner that you could hear, especially last year, a couple years ago when Xavier played well at Hinkle. But this year, it was completely different. On each side, it was completely empty up at the top. There were Xavier fans. It might have been a 60-40 split Butler-Xavier fans, in all honesty. And Xavier fans were louder the entire time. Butler fans really never were into the game at all. It was just a really weird atmosphere, because I had never seen Hinkle like that before. It's always been a really crazy atmosphere for a college basketball game, and last night it wasn't cool at all. There was nothing cool about that place last night.
What, you don't like pissing in a trough?
No. Well, here's the best part about that is that they changed everything with like their media parking and where you pick up your media passes and everything, and no one had a clue where to direct people. So all the Xavier media people are getting frustrated because there weren't parking spots where they said there were supposed to be parking spots. We drove all around. We walked into gates, and they don't know where to tell us to go. They're telling us to keep going around the doors. And so I got in, and they tell me to go to another gate to go get my media pass. And I said, well, are you sure my media pass is going to be there? He goes, pretty sure. And I'm like, well, you're 0-for-2 on the pretty sures. So I just bolted past him and walked right in without a ticket or anything. And like, they really didn't do anything. Now at Cintas, I would have had a red dot on me. A sniper probably would have taken me down already. But in Butler, I just walked. I mean, I could have walked in and sat down. There weren't, I mean, like I said, the place was empty. There would have been no problem just strolling into a Butler game without a ticket, a media pass or anything. I did end up walking down over there to find it. But then later on, I was talking to Tom Iser, Xavier's SID, and we see one Brian Snow, my intern, there at the game last night.
Well, and he was obsessed. He was only there to see the dog.
Yeah, exactly. So he was there to pet a bulldog. But we see him, and I'm talking to Snow, and he's like, he's trying to figure out where to pick up his media credential, because he had just walked in the doors the same way I did without any ticket or media credential at all. So he eventually got officially credentialed and suited up there as well. So he was all good. But, Rick, Iser made a good point that it is tougher to get pointed in the right direction if you look like a homeless man, Snow.
Well, Rick, I would not try that trick at Madison Square Garden. They may take you down. We may never see you again.
I'm telling you, you can't do that at Cintas. You cannot walk in like that.
Here's some things that I've observed about Hinkle. I've been to a couple games. First of all, they sell Chick-fil-A sandwiches at the concession stand, which is huge for me. Secondly, that place, I was there the first time I ever went there for a Xavier Butler game when I've been an adult was the clock game. And that was one of the most raucous atmospheres I've ever seen for a college basketball game, because and people forget this because of all the drama at the end of the game. But Butler was up 17 points in the first half of that game. And Jordan Crawford and actually our buddy Brad Redford made a couple huge shots at the end of the first half to get it down to like 6 points, I want to say. And then the second half, Jason Love and Kenny Freeze were just absolutely abusing Matt Howard and the other big man they had there. I don't think it was Andrew Smith, who, by the way, our best wishes to him. Yeah. But the other big man they had prior to Smith, and that was one of the craziest basketball atmosphere. So it's a little bit unfortunate that Hinkle was a bit of a mausoleum for the game last night.
Yeah, well, it was pretty cool seeing obviously David West and a couple of his Pacer teammates sitting across from Xavier. Roy,
it was Paul George, George Hill, and Roy Hibbert, I think.
Yeah, and of course the only time Butler's security was doing anything was protecting those guys. I heard it was ridiculous the lockdown they had the NBA players on without letting anyone get to him. But when Xavier fans up top started chanting David West and clapping, that's when the Bulldog, who was sitting like I guess like four rows behind me and I didn't realize it, just started going nuts and barking. And with it being so silent down in the Butler section, that's all you could hear for like a good minute 30 of the game is just the Bulldog barking right behind me. And I'm like, this is ridiculous. Snow, go pet him or something. Get him to calm down.
Rick, before we leave the discussion on the Butler game, I want to ask you about sort of a strategic difference between the way Xavier guarded the best player on the opposing team this week. Because against Bryce Cotton, who is a small, super quick guard, the Musketeers used Samaje Christen, who's a bigger guard. He's a 6'3 guy. Instead of Dee Davis, who had, you know, is 5'10 maybe. And that worked extremely well. That was a matchup Chris Mack chose, and it worked well in sort of the team concept. Against Kellen Dunham, who of course is 6'6 and can shoot over any guard in the Big East, the Musketeers used Dee Davis, who's 10 inches shorter than he is, or I guess 7 or 8 inches shorter than he is. What is it about those matchups that makes that height differential work for Xavier? Because a lot of times you would be surprised to see a team put a big guard on a super quick point guard like Cotton, or use a small guard on a big shooter like Dunham.
Yeah, well, it all comes down to, well, first of all, D is the best defender on the team, and where he really excels and what he does even better than Samaje can do is chasing guys around screens. When you've got a shooter like Dunham who's running off staggered screens and he's put through a ton of situations, D is really good at avoiding those screens. He's elusive. He's a tough target to hit. Samaje is just a bigger target, easier to screen, and has a harder time. He just doesn't get around him near as well, and D's very good at that for whatever reason, and part of it is just the fact that he's small. And so the one thing that's special about D, and I've talked to him about this, and he attributes a lot of it to when he came in, he got bullied by Mark and Two and guys who wanted to play really physical with him, who weren't, you know, Two especially wasn't necessarily trying to beat you with his quickness. He was usually trying to get a shoulder on you and really drive you into the lane with his strength and his power. D had to figure out a way to combat that and how to deal with guys who are stronger than him initially, because he was so weak when he first came in. Now he's done a much better job of really working hard in the weight room in the offseason and building up his strength to the point that now he can handle himself much better physically, but he's also learned all these tactics and learned how to deal against bigger guards. And even now, you know, you're working in practice, you're going against a guy like Samaje or Remy Abel or Dante Jackson. So, you know, he's had that experience against these bigger guys that he has to guard, and it's really helped him in his career to prepare him for that. You look at this year already, he's been great against Dunham twice, or at least in the second half the first time around after he was in trouble, the foul trouble the first half, and then he did really well against D'Angelo Harrison, who is about as physical of a guard as you'll find in the Big East. So he does a great job against that. Now, why Samaje is such a much better matchup on Bryce Cotton, despite D being much closer to his size, is just that D lacks the elite quickness that those two other guys have. I mean, Bryce Cotton is so quick. And the one thing that Mac did say is when you look at what Bryce Cotton's done in the conference, the times he struggled is when teams have been able to just keep him in front and be around him on a shot, because he is smaller. He struggles to finish around size a little bit more if you can be near him. And D just had a hard time, one, contesting his shot because he's just as small as he is, and two, staying in front of him. And Samaje did a better job of that, obviously.
All right, Rick, we were next going to sort of do a rundown of where the Big East is, but actually that was the first question that we were asked in the thread on the message board. So why don't we just start there? First question from Brown Lavender. I'm not quite sure. That's an interesting color scheme. I don't think that it probably would get far on in Milan. But he asked us to do a rundown on how we see the conference standings ending up at the end of conference play, who might be rising to the top and who might be joining Butler at the bottom of the league. And so this is an interesting question, because the Big East this year has been a little bit, other than the top two teams, Villanova and Creighton, and the bottom two teams, DePaul and Butler, this conference has really been unpredictable. If you look, there are 32 conferences in Division I right now. And if you look at the home winning percentage, home teams have won 33 of the 56 games played in the Big East so far this year, not including tonight. That's a 59% winning percentage. That's only 23rd out of those 32 conferences. So home court advantage has not been as decisive or dispositive as we thought it might be. And there's been a relatively low number of both close games and blowouts. So most of the games have been in that sort of 5 to 15 point range. This is a league that's very bunched right now. You have Villanova 9-1, you have Creighton 9-2. At the bottom, you have DePaul 2-9, Butler 2-10. DePaul and Butler aren't going anywhere this year. Villanova and Creighton are in the NCAA tournament, even if they lose out. So then you've got this huge middle class of six teams, with Xavier at the top right now and Seton Hall at the bottom, all of which have the opportunity, if they make a run during this last third of the Big East conference schedule and then the Big East conference tournament at Madison Square, to potentially grab an at-large bid. So, Rick, when you break down the remaining schedules for these teams, who do you see as a potential riser and who do you see as a potential faller?
Initially, my first thought is St. John's has the most upside to rise here late in the season. When you look man for man, they're bringing Orlando Sanchez off the bench right now.
Hold on, Rick. Let me just say, St. John's currently 5-6. Their remaining schedule is they play at Seton Hall tonight. So I don't know what the result of that was. They play home to Georgetown, home to Butler, away at Villanova, host Xavier and DePaul, and at Marquette. So four of their last six games are at home.
Yeah, four of the last six are at home, and I don't think they have as tough of a schedule when you look at, they've got Georgetown and Butler back-to-back at home, both winnable games with the way that they've been playing recently. They go to Seton Hall, they can win that game. Nova's going to be tough, obviously, but then they've got X and DePaul at home back-to-back, not too bad, and then at Marquette, so they finish up. I could see them finishing 11-7 easily with the way that they have been playing of late. And like I mentioned, with all the talent that they have, if they continue to get hot and play to their potential, they're as good as anyone in this conference, and they're a team you don't want to face in the tournament. Now, that being said, we know St. John's. We know Steve Lavin coaches them. That's probably not all that likely. I mean, they do have that upside, but I don't see it happening just because that's not their MO. They usually fold. They usually play inconsistently. I don't see them continuing this hot streak that they've been on. When you look at the top three teams, Creighton, Villanova, and X, all of them have tough road games ahead. I could see Xavier. It's going to be such an interesting finish to the conference play, because I could legitimately see X going 12-6 or 9-9. I could see that going either way or anything in between that.
Yeah, I mean, certainly it's possible. And other than the home game against DePaul, all of those other five games, you could legitimately ultimately project going either way and not be that surprised by. The team I see when I look at this as a potential faller is Georgetown. That's a team that has very minimal depth, as we know. And they have to play four of their last six games. They're sitting 6-6 right now. They have to play four of their last six games on the road. They're at St. John's. They're at Seton Hall. They host Xavier. They're at Marquette. They host Creighton, and then they're at Villanova. So those last four games are pretty much brutal for them. Georgetown has a really compelling out-of-conference, or has a pretty compelling resume as of right now, even sitting 6-6 in the conference because of that huge non-conference win over Michigan State a couple weeks ago. But when you look at that run-in, if a Georgetown team is sitting 8-10 in the Big East Conference, do they get a look in for an at-large bid? I think it's going to be pretty dicey for them. As of right now, I would say that Georgetown has – as of right now, if the season ended today, I would say Georgetown has the fourth-best resume in the Big East behind Nova, Creighton, and Xavier.
Yeah, I think they need to go at least 9-9 to get a look.
Right. But I think 9-9 may get them in.
Yeah, I do too. I think they're good enough to do it. And I think if you're, you know, as a conference, I think that's who you want to rise, because you look at these other teams, DePaul's going to continue to tumble. They lost Cleveland, Melvin, even against their weaker schedule down the stretch, they're going to continue to tumble. And Marquette is a team I really see struggling down the stretch because of their schedule. When you look at, they play Xavier and Creighton back to back at home. At DePaul's a very winnable game, but then they've got Georgetown, at Nova, at Providence, and St. John's to finish the season. I don't see Marquette finishing very strong at all.
All right, Rick. Is there any way that, well, first of all, let me ask you this. Who's your pick to win the conference, knowing what we know about the remaining schedules? And Villanova beat DePaul tonight, so they're 10-1, so they're a game up.
I think Villanova wins it, but I mean it's very possible Creighton can too, although Creighton's shown a little more vulnerability on the road, I think, than Villanova has, because Villanova's so good defensively, whereas Creighton relies so much on their offensive output that I think Villanova will be a little more consistent. But both of them have very tough road games on this final stretch.
See, I'm actually kind of leaning toward Creighton maybe having the upper hand here because they host Villanova in their run-in, and Creighton has been virtually invincible at home this season.
Right.
And you know, you look at their road games, their toughest road game probably coming home is Xavier.
Yep.
They have to go to Georgetown, but you know, the Georgetown home environment is questionable sometimes. And I don't know. I mean, I look at Nova, and I guess that both of these are pretty elite teams, but Nova does have to play at Creighton. They have to play at Providence. They have to play at Xavier. Creighton lost at Providence. Creighton beat the hell out of Villanova at Villanova. So you would certainly expect that Creighton game to be difficult for them. You would expect that Providence game to be pretty difficult for them. And you would certainly, I mean, as partisan as we are, perhaps, you would expect that game at Xavier to be difficult for them. So I think this could be a situation where 14-4 wins this league. 15-3, 14-4 may be where those teams end up. I mean, as a Xavier fan, as I am, you know, that Seton Hall game hurts more and more when you look at this, because if the Musketeers had beaten Seton Hall, they'd be sitting 8-3, and they're all of a sudden in the mix to get to that second seed. And maybe if Villanova has some stumbles, maybe that game on Senior Day at Cintas Center could be for a share of the conference title. But as it stands, it looks like the Muskies are really fighting for third place. So that's a great question. I think we've given it.
I think the overriding takeaway from all of this, Dan, is we just don't know. And that speaks to how deep this conference is. There's so much parity right now that all of these teams, it's a complete toss up down the stretch. I think any of these teams could finish 500 with the remaining schedule, and you'd be like, yeah, I could see that. Even Villanova and Creighton.
All right, our guy Alpha Muskie asks, on our thoughts regarding the roster for next year, specifically, but he and we'll deal with that more in the offseason, but he specifically asks whether Justin Martin's status has changed. I think there's been a general thought that Justin Martin would graduate this year and probably do a graduate transfer, but he's had a pretty good year for the Musketeers. Do you get a read on what his status is for next year, what you expect him to do?
No, I mean, right now he's 100% a part of this team. I don't, you know, there's nothing about him leaving or anything like that. The only thing we know right now is that he has the that option, if he graduates this year, to go ahead and pursue that 1 year of graduate school elsewhere and be eligible immediately. But that, you know, there's nothing that's been said about him exercising that at this point.
Okay. And then RC42 East, who I guess a new subscriber, asked two questions. First of all, he'd like to know our report card grades for the freshmen so far. So Rick, why don't you put those out there first, I guess?
Well, I guess starting off with Kamal Richards, you got to go INC, right? I mean, he obviously tore the ACL, so we haven't really seen anything of him. He didn't get in much before that. With Miles Davis, I think you've got to go with a C+. And the reason I'll say C+, I think he was at closer to a B at the beginning of the season through the first half of the non-conference schedule. He had played a big role in some of those wins and scored in the teens and showed off his outside jumper. He went through that really cold stretch there offensively. And then really what happens when a shooter like that doesn't make shots from the outside is the rest of the flaws are all of a sudden magnified times 100. And people start realizing he's not a great defender and he's slower. And teams in the Big East have really noticed that. I think that's one thing you saw in that Providence game was they really, really attacked Miles with set plays every time he was on the court. And that's why you saw Josh Fortune get so many open looks, because they're running set plays right at Miles Davis when he was guarding him. I mean, Providence doesn't ever run set plays for Josh Fortune regularly. So again, Miles, I'd go C+. For Brandon Randolph, I'd go C-. And really, the biggest thing for Brandon is that he hasn't been able to make shots at all this year. At any point, he really just hasn't finished well at all offensively. He showed more promise early in the year when he was playing more minutes. He was athletic enough defensively, but as it turned out, he started to get beat as the season wore on a little bit more and make a few more mistakes. And then his offensive struggles and his decision making, he lost so much confidence on that end that his defense just wasn't good enough to make up for it anymore and warrant him being on the court as much as he originally was. You know, I think everyone expected a little bit more out of him offensively, and certainly he needs to figure out a way to get him his confidence to the point that he can be a difference maker and an asset defensively, because he is very athletic, and I don't think anyone should be ready to write him off. But right now I think C- is the best you could do for Brandon Randolph. But keep in mind that, I mean, he is a freshman who played a significant role early in the season, especially, you know, when D was out for a little bit and playing less when he was getting worked back in the lineup. So again, Brandon Randolph is not a guy to give up on yet, but he certainly hasn't reached the potential that I think a lot of people were hoping he would reach by this point. Then you go with Jalen, and obviously he started off so much slower than everyone had anticipated, but I think a lot of that also was because of the fact that they didn't need him. They had James Farr playing well, contributing and giving them offensive production, which is what they really needed out of the bench. And so they were able to dangle that carrot for Jalen and really say, you need to learn what we want out of you on in the defensive system and where you need to be offensively. And you can't just rely on your athletic ability. Had they been in a pinch and had to play him more, I think he would have continued to get better and better. And he may already be more a part of the team. But I think long term, this is better for his development, because I think, like I said, they were able to dangle that carrot while James was playing well and say, no, you've got to learn things a little bit better. You've got to do it our way and really get to know the system and get comfortable with it. And I think that's helped his confidence. And ultimately, right now, we're seeing him foul a lot less. He looks a lot more comfortable out there on the floor in his positioning, and he's starting to make plays. So I think for Jalen Reynolds, you've got to go at this point a B-.
You are brutal.
What?
I mean, some of those are just brutal grades. I guess my thing is this. There, in the last decade.
What if Samaje had been last year?
A+.
Okay. So if that's where we're starting, you don't think these guys are a couple letter grades lower?
Well, I mean,
Jalen Reynolds is one letter grade lower?
Samaje might have been like an A++++. I guess I don't have that high of expectations of freshmen generally. I have a little bit higher expectation of Miles and Jalen because they, you know, even though they weren't practicing with the team last year, they were at least integrated into the sort of the college lifestyle and didn't have as much adjustment period as maybe the other guys. I would say that this freshman that it's difficult to give a letter grade to a freshman class because it's not really that important what they do this year. It's more what you see, the signs that you see for their development going forward. I would agree with you that Jalen Reynolds would get the highest grade for me so far. I would agree with you that Kamal's got to be an incomplete because of his injury and because of his inability to crack the rotation prior to that. I'd probably say I would probably agree that Miles is in that B-C+ area.
Wait, so what the hell are you saying I'm brutal for if you agree with everything I just said?
I think you're selling Brandon Randolph a little bit short. I really do. I think he's been better than what you're saying. I just think that because D. Davis has been much better this year than perhaps I expected, maybe the coaches.
But Dan, D's had two extended periods where he's struggled, and Brandon had a great opportunity to earn more minutes with his play, and he wasn't able to do anything. So I'm not at all saying Brandon Randolph has been terrible or he hasn't met expectations as a freshman. You're absolutely right. He's a freshman. But see, where I think we have a disconnect is you're one of those really smart people who B+ was like below average. So you're thinking when I say C, it means that he was terrible. C is average to me, would be average. So I say, you know, Brandon Randolph's been a little below average expectations for what I thought of him coming in.
Dude, I went to law school, man. Somebody got an A- in law school. They were on suicide watch. So, yeah, you're probably right. Moving on to the second question from the same poster. He asks, our overall thoughts on the move to the Big East? We'll skip that one. But maybe the things that we miss from the Atlantic 10, which is an interesting question. And the glib response is nothing.
I was going to say, hold on, let me tally up my list.
I would say that I would miss playing teams like Temple, St. Joseph's, St. Louis, programs that I have a lot of respect for, teams that X has played over the last, you know, decade and a half, and I've seen some really nice games between the two of them. This is not going to be popular on this show, but I think that I think that the Xavier-Dayton rivalry should continue in some form. I don't know how that would – I don't know what the best way for that to happen would be. But I would say that there are some schools that were in the Atlantic 10 that Xavier had a nice history with. And if Temple was to show up – I mean, hopefully they get better than they are this year. But if Temple was to show up in 2 or 3 years as a home-and-home, I think I'd be perfectly fine with that.
Well, at this point for me, it's absolutely nothing. I don't miss anything about it. I don't miss the TV schedule. I don't miss not being able to watch those other A-10 teams play their other conference games. Right now, I'm able to watch pretty much every Big East game that my heart desires on FS1. So they get every team on, it seems like, each week. So that's been great from that perspective. And then you mentioned a couple teams that when they're really good, they're in the national spotlight a little bit. They move the needle a little bit in the national spotlight. But I like to be able to listen to these national podcasts or watch these national college basketball shows and see some of these teams in Xavier's conference talked about. And that's it's a lot more fun covering a team for me from that perspective. When they're talked about in the national spotlight, they matter a whole lot more. And in the Big East, they do. Xavier's talked about a whole lot more, in my opinion, in the national spotlight. Now, obviously, ESPN is kind of doing their whole little boycott thing on the Big East, and that's cute. But they're still, when I listen to the Ion College Basketball Podcast or whatever, it's constantly talking about Creighton, Villanova, Xavier, Marquette, Georgetown. They're in the spotlight this year, and so are all the other teams that are in their conference. Heck, even DePaul and St. John's, when things happen, when Seton Hall, when things happen with them, it's talked about. When things happened with LaSalle and Fordham and St. Bonaventure and even St. Joe's and Temple and UMass, when it wasn't a good year for them or an up year where they were in the top 25, it didn't even hit the radar. People just didn't care about the A-10, and I don't miss that at all.
By the way, one thing I definitely don't miss about the A-10 10 is the annual February cannibalization of the at-large teams in the Atlantic 10. The sort of the it's sort
the
of
Big East is doing the same thing right now.
That's true, but it's sort of a rite of late winter that any team that looked like they were good for the first 3 months of the year, George Washington right now, will take a swan dive, and Dayton as well, will take a swan dive once they get into conference and completely screw themselves. I watched the first half of the GW game tonight against VCU, and they got absolutely boat raced. So, I mean, that's sort of a tradition.
Oh, I got another one.
10, I guess.
I don't miss the crappy generic East Bay Jordan jerseys either that we'd see throughout the Atlantic 10.
What about
I like seeing big time sponsorships.
What about games played in some guy's garage?
Yeah, the high school gyms, the Covington Latin Silvergrove Daytons of the A10. I don't miss those games. Yeah, there's not much that I miss about the A10 at all, if anything, to be honest.
Well, let's move, Rick. We'll talk about. We were supposed to have Snow on the show tonight. Instead, he's drinking champagne.
Hold on, I do
Cristal
have
in somebody's luxury box at the Pacers game. So
that's right. I do have one other comment on that, though. I would say, as a fan base, one thing that people might come to miss is those games where you can right the ship. When Xavier was on that 3-game losing streak, it was because they had to play against three good teams in a row when they weren't playing really well. If you would have sprinkled in a Fordham or a LaSalle in there, guess what? They probably don't lose three.
Can
in
we
a row.
Say Fordham and Duquesne now when we're doing our generic thing? Because LaSalle, at least give Dr. John 1 year having made the Sweet 16 last year.
No, because that's the thing. Even if it was LaSalle, and it's just not the same. I'm sorry.
No, it definitely is true. And I would also say that with the exception of the Seton Hall game, the home atmosphere for the Big East games this year has been tremendous.
Yeah, it's been a very noticeable difference. And that's fun. This is what basketball is about. So I don't know. That'll be the only thing. I mean, you're seeing it for UC. UC is not a great team, as SMU just exposed. They still have the same flaws that Xavier exposed a few weeks ago. But when you're able to gain confidence and you're able to get some of your young guys a lot of experience against teams that you know you're not going to lose to, you can all of a sudden go to Louisville and win a game when you only have to do it once. But in the Big East, you saw UC do the same thing. They would go on losing stretches when they weren't playing well. So,
well, that's true.
that's one thing people will come to miss. If you wanted Xavier to win this conference every year, it's not going to happen.
Oh, God, I've complimented Dayton. Now I'm going to compliment UC. I think, UC's a flawed team, but there are about 300 teams in Division I that like to have their flaws.
They're a good – don't get me wrong. They're a good team. But, Dan, if they were in the Big East, they would have four losses at least. They would.
I don't know. A team wins at Louisville and a team blows out Memphis at Memphis. I got a little respect for that.
Dan, I don't disagree with you, but SMU isn't a whole lot better than a lot of the mid-level Big East teams right now. Would you agree with that?
I would say that they probably are similar to a lot of those middle-class Big East teams. Yeah, but right. As we saw when Providence boat raced Creighton, some of those middle class teams can rise up and bite you in the hindquarters, even an elite team like Creighton.
That's what I'm saying. So if you see with the struggles they had early on in the conference play, scoring the ball at times when they didn't have Troy Calpain playing well or Jermaine Sanders wasn't making any shots, before those guys gained some confidence and were able to play well at Louisville, if those guys struggle through those first few games and they don't get as many minutes because Mick has to leave the veterans on the floor more, you maybe don't win as many of these games as UC has. What they have is they have several teams at the back ends of the top 100 of the RPI and into the 200s of the RPI that they're able to kind of get fat off of and gain some confidence because they know they're not going to lose. And then it's just different when you only have to do it once, when you get seven games leading up to that one big one where you can gain confidence and work guys through issues and still win games. In the Big East, you just can't do that. If you have issues, they get exposed.
Well, certainly the ACC is one of the most unique conferences I've ever seen. They currently have five teams in the top 31 of the Pomeroy rankings. Xavier's like 38th. And then they have five teams that are lower than DePaul in the Pomeroy ratings. So half the league is absolutely abysmal and half the league is pretty good. So we shall see. I think the NCAA tournament is going to prove a lot about the strength of that league, particularly teams like SMU, Memphis, and even UConn. You know, how good are those teams really when they get on the national stage, when they don't have this absolutely atrocious bottom division of your conference? You can just, you know, eat their lunch on a weekly basis. Rick, let's move on to maybe the biggest, I think, for the sort of our potpourri section today. We wanted to hit probably the two biggest stories in college sports over the last week. One, the Marcus Smart incident at Oklahoma State, or in the Oklahoma State Texas Tech game. I'm sorry, it was at Lubbock. And the Michael Sam situation at Missouri, and then going into the NFL Combine. On the Smart situation, what was your take? I mean, the difference between you and me is that I grew up and still am a fan. I sit in the stands, I yell at the refs, I do everything else. You, for the most part, have been on press row. What's your take on this situation? I mean, what was your response when you first heard and saw these images from Lubbock, Texas?
Well, here's my first issue with it. I knew who Jeff Orr was before this happened, okay? Anytime you know who a booster is at a school, or you hear someone say he's a well-known booster, or that's written in a story, you know why that guy's well-known? It's because he does dumb things that people notice. It's because he thinks he's a part of the team. It's because he's too attached to it. He goes over the top and people know him because of that. That's how boosters become well-known boosters. So right there, that was my issue. When I heard it was this guy, I said he did something stupid. Now, whether he said something racial to Marcus Smart or not, I don't know. I think everyone would pretty much widely accept that Smart's response wasn't necessarily acceptable. It's not the way you want him to react. But all I know is we continuously call, especially the NCAA, continuously calls these players on these college basketball teams student athletes. And I myself am not someone who's been all that good in my life at letting people talk crazy to me. And the 18-year-old version of me when I was in college, or 19-year-old version, or 20-year-old version, or maybe even 21-year-old version, I just can't. Yes, he deserves a suspension. I don't really have a problem with that, but we need to hold Jeff Orr accountable. He's the adult who's crossing a line. Whatever he said to him, it was something that he said he regretted. So why are you doing that? Why are you cheering against other kids? I've never understood that. Go and cheer for your team, but why are you cheering against college-age students? And as for Marcus Smart, he crossed a line he shouldn't have crossed. Don't do it. But at the same time, I don't think he's a bad kid. I don't think this is a red flag for him going into the draft. I don't think this is a personality flaw. If it is, then I had those same personality flaws, because I might have done the same thing. I'd like to think I wouldn't have, but I couldn't hold him to a standard that I wouldn't have held my 18-year-old self to.
This is a tough one for me, because first of all, the idea that this Orr guy used a racial slur to Marcus Smart is to me a little bit of a dispositive question. Because if he just yells something, if he just calls him a piece of crap, that makes him look like an idiot. But I don't understand why Marcus Smart went completely ballistic on the
right
guy.
But that's why it's tough to believe that's what he said. First of all, who uses that as an insult?
It is tough to believe. But if you look at the video, I mean, this is something that's so far out of my range of experience, I wouldn't know what to think. But I've never been to Lubbock, Texas, so maybe this is okay. But if you scream a racial slur at the top of your lungs, I would think people would turn around and look at you as though you just sprouted a second head. So that's the only reason. And I also think that there may be that Marcus Smart may have realized that he screwed up, and he sort of went to that as the
But Dan, the reaction was immediately, like, it's something that set him off. So
whatever was said,
because it wouldn't have been something that was racial that was said to me, right? Like, I never had that issue in my life. Somebody but there were things.
You, somebody asked if you were from Latonia.
Right. If someone was talking smack about Latonia to the 18-year-old version of me, I can't guarantee that I wouldn't have gone off and pushed him or something at that moment, especially when I'm frustrated in the heat of a battle. Why are you cheering against this kid? That's what I don't understand. You're an adult. You're an adult in the stands. And there's no security, by the way. That's another issue that I don't know at what point with all this money the NCAA is making, they're going to address to a certain extent. But it, I mean, we saw it at the Crosstown Shootout. They're lucky that nothing happened between the fans and the players in that situation when things turned sour, because there was nothing that the security in place could have done about it. There wasn't near enough to stop that. And the access, especially a lot of these NBA arenas that college teams are playing, is way too great. I mean, it's way too easy for something like that to happen.
We're lucky
it was just a push, Dan, and not a punch.
Yeah, a lot of these old field houses are, I mean, well, you were at Hinkle yesterday.
Yeah.
You can just basically walk out on the floor. I mean, it's a it's a tough issue, and I think that it's been jacked up to a ridiculous degree for a couple reasons. First of all, because Marcus Smart was involved in that very high profile decision to come back to school this year. And this season maybe has not gone the way he had hoped it has. A lot of his frailties as a player have been exposed this year, and Oklahoma State seems to be on a nosedive headed for the NIT at this point after being at one point in the top five in the country.
But I don't even need that narrative. Like, the media wants to paint that narrative, and maybe that's part of it. Maybe that's why he's frustrated. But
no, I'm saying
maybe
that's that's why the media is going crazy about it. I think it's because it's a high-profile player. Also, do not forget this, Rick. This is something that happened on an ESPN game during the Winter Olympics, and ESPN has no access to live video of the of NBC's coverage of the Olympics.
Right.
Of course they went crazy about it because this moves the needle. So I don't condone what Marcus Smart did. I'm not going to try to say that.
Is it a red flag in your opinion for his draft? Because I've heard that a lot this week, that this is something, like it or not, right or wrong, that NBA GMs are going to look at and say, he's got an attitude issue. And do you agree with that or not?
I will quote an anonymous scout that I saw somebody quote on Twitter. It may have been Jeff Goodman. The red flag is his inability to hit an outside shot. I don't care.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly how I feel about it. But I do think that this does bring up some interesting points, like I said, with the security, and that this is going to be an issue that's not going to go away. And something at some point worse will happen between fans and players, because fans are idiots. Look at Twitter. Fans are idiots when it comes to this stuff.
At a lot of places, everywhere, really, there's a contingent. But even at X, you know, this year, as you know, they've added all this courtside seating, and You always these are the high money donors, people that you would expect. But, you know, I turned my eyes back to last year when Marshall Henderson was giving it large to the Auburn student section. And you know what? He was trying to provoke a response. So it's just like it's a very slippery slope, because unlike football, which is way crazier, nobody really is going to run onto the field at Ohio Stadium to drill somebody, you know?
Yeah. I mean, there's not much harm you can do for one as long as they're in helmets and
right. Pads. Marcus Hall ran off the field at Michigan Stadium throwing up the double deuces, and it was probably the funniest thing I've ever seen.
Exactly.
But you know, basketball is such it's such a more intimate playing field, and there is this level of interest, and there are fans just sort of on the court. And I do think you're right. I think there needs to be a reassessment, especially at arenas that are not designed, especially at older arenas that don't have the kind of the built-in safeguards that a Cintas Center has, to avoid situations like this. But yeah, I mean, but at the end of the day, anytime a particular booster is well known to the news media and is described as a booster in the news media, that's a pretty good sign that NCAA violations are probably about to follow. So we were going to finish up with a discussion of the Michael Sam situation and some of the anonymous sourcing from the NFL, but this has run on long enough, so we'll save our discussion of that maybe to a off-season podcast closer to the NFL Combine.
Yeah, like it'll matter by then. Well, do you realize the day and age we live in right now?
I guess that's true. Somebody will do.
Manti Te'o didn't even matter during this NFL season at all. At all. Not once. There was not like one point where he mattered, which is astonishing to me.
Well, I don't know. The San Diego Chargers certainly mattered to my enjoyment of this football season, but in any event.
Yeah, but I couldn't ever imagine that guy being accepted in the locker room, Te'o, that being, and he's been fine. So I think it'll be a non-issue by that point. But anyway, like you said, we'll get into that discussion at another time, possibly. For the 44th Eric Davis edition of the Dan and Victory podcast, he's Dan. I'm Rick. Thanks for listening, everyone.